welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 20th of February 2023, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Spring is almost here, it's the beginning of another week, and we're here today to discuss the news that will be of interest particularly to British nationalists. And who better to discuss that with than Max Musson from Western Spring. Springtime as well, and Max Musson from Western Spring. I had a pun there and I didn't even realize it. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well indeed. It's good, actually. We've got some good stories to talk about today. It appears that in a number of respects, white people in this country that have been on the back foot for a long time are starting to get back onto the front foot, which is got to be good. And it gives everybody, I would think, cause to feel optimistic about the future.
Definitely. More and more people seem to be waking up to what's going on. We're starting to have more and more protests that are being organised by local people that are not happy about so-called asylum seekers being dropped off in hotels in their communities. And we also have people that are really sort of drawing attention to what they would call this woke issues, I guess, critical race theory, white privilege, white fragility, all these ways of attacking white people, whiteness that they talk about, and people that have always been brought up to just be completely colorblind are really shocked at this, because it's effectively telling them that white people, even though you're struggling to do your best to be completely colorblind, that's wrong. And what you should be doing is seeing race, and you should be making exceptions for certain races and not making exceptions for other races, particularly white people. And all white people are racist regardless of how colorblind they are. In fact, because they're colorblind, it means they're being racist. And people are really shocked at this. And it seems that there is going to be a court case over this, which apparently is the first one of its kind. And it centres around an NHS nurse who was working at the Tavistock Clinic. And we're used to hearing about the Tavistock Clinic because they were the ones that were transitioning children and giving them puberty blockers. And that's all been stopped now. They said that there wasn't enough evidence to show that that was the right way to be doing things. And the people that are coming to them need to have their psychological issues addressed. So they're setting up various different clinics for that around the country. And the Tavistock Clinic itself has been closed down. But besides that as well, it seems that there was a nurse there and she was told that whiteness was a bad thing and that white people are all racist, and this really upset her. So she complained about this and she was put on leave, and there was supposed to be an investigation, but there's been no investigation. And she was all in the news last week again about this, because I think she's taking them to court over this or having a tribunal or something. Max, I know you've been looking at this. Do you want to flesh it out a little bit, that story that I was just covering there?
Yeah, the story caught my eye. It was a story reported on the Mail Online, and it basically says that a Christian nurse was left with crippling anxiety after she was bullied by woke NHS chiefs for saying that being white doesn't mean you're racist. Amy Gallagher, 34, it says, a mental health nurse from Orpington, Kent, was on a forensic psychology course training to be a psychotherapist at the Portman Clinic, which is part of the Tavistock and Portman NHS Trust. In an exclusive interview with Mail Online, Amy has revealed how the NHS bosses caused her crippling anxiety after she challenged their racist and offensive views in lectures she was forced to attend. Lectures at the Tavistock and Portman NHS Trust told her whites don't understand the world and Christianity is responsible for racism because it's European, in a series of politically biased talks. And one of the Tavistock's seminars even called whiteness a problem for our time and included a description of on the Trust's website that the problem of racism is a problem of whiteness. And of course, what happens is that the people who are campaigners for equality, racial equality, and are the campaigners for all these left and woke causes, they try to damn us if we do and damn us if we don't. So, as you said earlier on, if people reject the notion that they have institutional racism or that they have white privilege, then they're attacked as being racist. And even those that claim that they have got, they're completely colorblind and they don't see race, they just see people as people, they get attacked and told that they still have this institutional racism within them, which causes them to discriminate against people who are non-white. And this is an issue, and certainly the case of Amy Gallagher indicates that we've reached a point now where well-meaning and professional people like Amy Gallagher have decided that they've had enough of having this sort of thing rammed down their throats. They've had enough of what is described as white fragility, which is the sort of angst that white people suffer whenever the issue of race is mentioned, because they know that as far as the equalities campaigners are concerned, that white people are damned if they do or damned if they don't. And so it's only natural, if you're in a situation where you are accused in that way, that you do feel anxious, that you do in trying to argue your way through without being labelled as being racist and therefore having people coming after you and trying to campaign for you to lose your job. You do feel a great degree of anxiety. What is perceived, in my view, what's perceived as white privilege and institutional racism is, in fact, simply the advantage enjoyed by the descendants of a founding group of a society or the founding group of a civilization that is derived from their similarity with that founding group, i.e. it's their cultural birthright. It's the cultural birthright of any people to enjoy the fruits of the labors of past generations, and to enjoy the culture that's been created by the founding members of their race or the founding members of their society. And this is true not just of white societies, it's also true of societies created by any ethnic group. For example, if I went to China, then what I would find is that Chinese society is that was created by people who are ethnically and racially Chinese, that their society that they've created would operate in a way which most closely matches the temperament and the needs and the aspirations of the Chinese people, which would it's what you'd expect to be the case. If you went to Africa, it'd be the same in Africa. But if I was in China and I decided to campaign against this, and it would be completely unreasonable of me to insist that the Chinese must restructure their society in such a way as to eliminate any affinity between Chinese society and the characteristics and the hopes and the aims of the indigenous Chinese people. And I think that if I or another white people went to China and started campaigning in the way that non-white people campaign and equalities groups campaign in this country in order to divest our society of any kind of cultural heritage, that it would be regarded as an act of hostility towards the Chinese people if I accused them of institutional racism, of unfairly benefiting from yellow privilege, or if I spoke about the problem of race being the problem of yellowness. That would be regarded as hostility on my part if I said those kind of things about the Chinese people. And so it has to work the other way around as well. So it has to work the other way around in support of white people living in countries created by white people, in societies created by white people, in civilizations created by white people. It has to work the other way around. There was, and it's quite true, there was, and to a lesser extent, there still is, an advantage to be derived by white people from living in societies created by our ancestors. But it's unreasonable aggression on the part of equalities campaigners active within our societies. And it's the result of moral feebleness on the part of white liberals that that can no longer be said. There are many instances, there are many situations where now it is actually a disadvantage in our society to actually be a white person. And poor Amy Gallagher has discovered herself in that kind of a situation. And it's no wonder then that white people who fear for the loss of their jobs if they're accused of being institutionally racist, that those people suffer anxiety as a result. And what we have is a society that's constantly under attack, that's constantly on the back foot by the equalities campaigners. And as I said at the beginning of this this item, it's good to see that people are starting to fight back. Amy Gallagher is one individual that started to fight back, and there are others that are now cropping up in the news that are beginning to fight back as well, and that's really, really good news.
It is excellent news, but I mean, it is strange. It's rather like saying coming to somebody's house, a family house, and saying, "Well, this is wrong. This house is all being set up for you, and the family that are within this house are all doing things for their own family, and this is wrong." It's like effectively they're saying that white people have something that black people or non-white people don't have, but black people have their own family. Non-whites have their own family. And what they're effectively saying is white people doing things for their own family is wrong. That's somehow a white privilege. But it's not something that everybody else doesn't have. Black people have their own people group. And their own people group should be doing things for their people group. Not complaining that white people are doing things for the white people group. And I guess what this has all come about, why this has all come about, is because we have invited these other groups, these non-white groups, to come and live in our countries. And because they're now living in our countries, and because we're saying to them, you are essentially the same as us, we'll give you the same name as us, it doesn't matter who your ancestry is, if you were born in this country, that means you're the same as us. So we're effectively telling them that they're the same as us. And then they're saying, well, but you're doing things in a different way. Why aren't you doing things the way that we want them done? And the reason for that is because they're a different people group. I mean, it's just a ridiculous situation that we've ended up putting ourselves in. But that's the cause of it. We've invited these people over here, and now they're saying, well, you've been telling us that we've been here all this time, because we're now trying to insert them into our history. We insert them into our historical plays to pretend that black people and non-white people have always been in white countries. So they say, well, if we've been here for all this time, why aren't you doing things the way we want them done? Why are you doing things the way you want them done? And it just creates all of this confusion. It's because we've tried to separate people from their ancestry, and we try to say, well, the thing that binds everybody together is where they're born. It's as if saying, you've got all these different animals that use a field, and saying, well, they're all the same animal because they all use the same field. But they're not. You've got rabbits, you've got badgers, you've got mice, you've got rats. And it's like saying they're all the same because they're all born in the same field. That's not the way that things work. And it's all this confusion comes about because of it, and all of this resentment, because there is differences between groups. There are measurable differences in statistics between groups in averages. And you get some groups that have higher IQs and are more achieving than other groups who have lower average IQs and are less achieving and have different life outcomes. And because of that, they say, well, no, it can't possibly be because this group is different to that other group. It must be because that other group is oppressing this group, and that's why there is that difference there. And that's what all of this is based upon. And that's why they say, well, it's not good enough to just be completely race blind and treat everybody with a meritocracy, because if you have a meritocracy, the group with the higher averages in the statistical differences is going to rise to the top. And we can't have that because we're all living together in this society. So we have to make all these changes to try to give this other group a leg up. And all that ends up then, you just end up with everybody in society resenting each other, and you end up with all the standards lowering, and you end up with this bizarre situation where one group can start complaining about whiteness in the white group, whereas if white people were to start complaining about blackness, they would be accused of inciting hate and reducing non-whites down to their race and basing things on race. So we have this complete inconsistency here. And the Tavistock group are being quite open about this, that this is, you know, this is what they're doing. I've got their page open here, Tavistock and Portman NHS. Remember, this is the National Health Service for the whole country that are doing this. And they say this presentation is rooted in the assumption that the problem of racism is a problem of whiteness. So the whole thing is rooted in the assumption that white people are racist, and there's no getting away from that. If you describe somebody as white, you're effectively, that person there is a racist. And then they say an examination of this construct of whiteness needs to be central to seeking a solution to this destructive dynamic. So they're saying white people are destructive. You know, the people that brought us civilization, the people that went to these non-white countries and built roads and built railways and hospitals and universities, taught them how to read and write, gave them our medicine, gave them access to all of our technology. You know, the most creative people group that has ever existed is being now being described as somehow being a destructive dynamic. Somehow we are a destructive people. And they say a key and urgent question then for those of us who are regarded as white is, how do we interrogate our whiteness to bring about the radical change that is required? So they're effectively saying, how can we stop being white? How can we stop being a so-called racist? Well, we must do everything we can for these other groups instead of doing it for our own group, which is effectively like saying to the father of a family, you need to stop providing for and protecting your own family. You need to provide for and protect this other family that lives up the road. And of course, the question then is, well, who's going to look after my family? If I'm devoting all my time to looking after this family up the road, nobody's going to be looking after my family. And that's the essential part of this. And when people start thinking like that, because that is essentially what it is, and it may take people that don't study this sort of thing a while to realize it, but that is there in their subconscious mind, is the fact that it's their extended family and looking out for their own people that is actually being attacked here. So when they get upset about it, that's what then is described as white fragility. And there's a whole Wikipedia page on white fragility. It's a book that was actually put out by somebody, and the subtitle of the book is Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. And effectively, because they say only white people can be racist. And of course, we've been brought up to think, you know, racism is a terrible thing, and that means discriminating against one group in favor of another group. And of course, now we're being told you need to discriminate in the favor of black people and discriminate against white people. So they're saying all of this idea of racism that we've been told is so wrong over these years, we're now being told that we have to engage in racism, but it has to be against white people. So anybody with a slight amount of sense is going to look at that and say, well, this is wrong. We shouldn't be discriminating against anybody. I mean, how have we got to this situation where we're now being told we need to discriminate against people on the basis of their race? And it's simple. It's because we have created these multicultural countries, and they're unnatural, and you have to engage in all this unnatural self-hating behavior to try to continue them. And the more resources we put into this, and the more we try to stop with the racism, the more we end up with polls saying that people in society think that it's the racist that it has ever been. And it doesn't matter what you do to try to appease people that think like that, they're always going to have this suspicion that discrimination, somebody was discriminating against them because they were of a different ethnicity, because they were of a different type of person. And you're never going to get away from that. The only way you can stop all discrimination is if you have ethnostates. And to have an ethnostate, it doesn't necessarily mean you keep out everybody that is completely different to you. I mean, obviously in capital cities, you need to have people there from different ethnicities. But it does mean that the people that are ruling the country are made up of the people they are governing, and that the rules and the laws that they put in place are decided by that specific group and nobody else. I mean, that's the important point of it. And people will say, left people will say, well, that excludes all these other groups. Well, no, because all these other groups should have their own ethnostates, and they should be doing things for their benefit, and they would understand that. I mean, that's what they do in China, as you were bringing up there, Max. You can't go to China and then start complaining that they're doing things for the Chinese and not for white people. Why would they bother doing things for white people? They're Chinese. It's so obvious.
It's not white societies that are dysfunctional in the way that the equalities campaigners state. It's the multiracial and multicultural societies that are dysfunctional. And because these campaigners completely miss the target and are completely aiming what they're doing at the wrong people and are maligning the white people completely unnecessarily, that's why this, as you say, won't end until we have ethno states. And one of the worst pieces of legislation that's been introduced was the Equalities Act 2010, because the Equalities Act places the onus on public bodies to actively fight racism. Now, most of the public bodies are not equalities campaigning groups. Most public bodies are local councils, are NHS trusts, are schools, etc. So they're not skilled in doing what the Equalities Act demands of them. And so instead of spending a lot of time researching a subject, what happens is they turn to the people who are active campaigners for human rights and equalities, and they ask them to determine their policy to this end. And of course, these campaigners are extremists. They are extremists in every sense of the word, because what they want us to do is they want us to divest ourselves of our culture and our birthright, when they don't ask the same thing of anybody else. And they ask us effectively to surrender our country to wave after wave of migrants coming across the Mediterranean and coming across the Channel, when they don't expect that of anybody else. And that is the disparity, that is the double standard that is currently being practiced to the detriment of white people.
Yeah, I mean, it happens in all of these instances. I mean, we're talking about racial equality there, but when they're talking about sexual equality, the schools will get in LGBTQ promoting organisations like Stonewall or Mermaids, so that they can say, look, this is what we're doing to promote equality. And effectively what they have in there is they have activists, left-wing activists, trying to push the envelope as much as they can in their direction, rather than somebody who is looking at this and saying, well, let's try and be objective about this. As you pointed up there, Max, you have this equality law, which means that all of these companies have to fight racism. Okay, at the time that law was brought in place, racism meant discriminating against one group in favour of another group, discriminated against people on the colour of their skin. And what they've done now is they've redefined racism as whiteness, as it can only apply to white people. I mean, it says it here. It says whiteness is a lived experience and a substantial factor in how one navigates the world and how one is navigated around by others. The fragility, the colorblind approach, and the silencing process of disavowal that develops in the childhood of white liberal families are a means of maintaining white privilege and racism. A psychoanalytical approach can therefore be useful in understanding these psychological implications, but only as one part of a wider perspective. So they're even going after liberals here. They're saying the liberal families, this view of being race blind effectively and taking people on merit, is completely wrong. And racism is inextricably linked with whiteness. Being a white person means you are racist, is effectively what they're saying here. And it is.
So we're damned whatever we do.
Yeah. Specifically attacking white people, and saying, yeah, here is their solution. The work required in relation to whiteness and the relinquishment of privilege is essential if we are to dismantle the system of racism that is so embedded within our society. I argue this is no altruistic endeavour, but that whilst clearly doing untold harm to black people, such a system also limits and distorts the development of white individuals and the society in which we are citizens. So they're somehow saying that if white people were doing everything for black people instead of doing things for white people, just to break it down to its essential components, they're saying that would actually be good for white people. And they're saying this is all embedded within our society. See, this is where this problem has come in, because we've invited in these other groups and then said, well, this is our society. It's all ours, and we share this. And you can't do that because each group is going to want to be doing what's best for its group. And that means the society is going to get pulled in all these different directions. If you did end up with white people doing everything for blacks, you would end up with non-whites saying you're not doing enough for non-whites. And then they would say you're not doing enough for the Chinese. And the Jews would say you're not doing enough for the Jews. And society is just constantly being pulled in different directions then, instead of having everybody pulling in the same direction, working to do the same thing for the best of everyone, which is this group. And I think what they're trying to do here, they're thinking, you know, well, this is what we need to be doing for the best of everyone. But you can't do what's best for everyone all at the same time. You know, you can only do what's best for one particular group. And if you had every group doing what was best for that group, then that would collectively be what's best for the world. But you can't do that all within one territory. That, you know, in order to do that, you have to have the people groups in separate territories all doing what is best for them. And then collectively, that is what's best for the world. You can't put them all together and say, well, they're all individuals. And now we need to do what's best for that whole group, because it's not possible. And we can see here that the way that they can try to make it possible means that one group has to stop doing what's best for its group. It has to relinquish its so-called privilege, which is what that one group has spent thousands of years building, the society they've been building. You have to relinquish all of that and hand it over to somebody else, is effectively what they're saying. It's so strange to me that, you know, we seem to be the only ones that can really break this down. But I think most white people, when they see it, they're uncomfortable with it. And that's why they've come up with this term white fragility, because they know that there is something wrong here. And essentially, that's what it is. You're being told that you need to stop doing things for your own family and instead do everything for this other family over here. And I think when you break it down like that, you know, it's very reasonable and it's easy to explain. But so many people just fall for it, don't they? They think, well, you know, we want to do away with racism, and these activists are telling us this is the way that we do away with racism. But effectively, it's not. It's just what some people, I guess, would call it reverse racism or positive discrimination. And it finds its the result of it in diversity quotas and saying, well, you've got to replace a certain number of white people in this role because we've got to have black people and non-white people in that role so that black and non-white people see themselves reflected and they see that it is possible for them to get to these positions, gives them something to go for. You know, they come out with all these very, very persuasive ideas about how it will improve society. But that just means that you end up with people being put into positions simply because of their race, simply because of their ethnicity, not because of merit, not because of qualifications. And then when that starts to happen in important parts of society, like engineering, pilots, working in hospitals, doctors, high-powered positions, then some very, very awful things could go wrong. I mean, we've just had a big train crash in Ohio, and lots of pollution that's come from it. And you wonder who it was that was driving the train. I mean, we had a bridge that collapsed, and that bridge, they were saying, isn't this wonderful? This was the first bridge built by diversity. It was all women that built this bridge. And it's the same thing when you put people into positions that are there simply because of their ethnicity or their sexuality, rather than because of merit, then you end up with these problems. It can all be boiled down to this crazy idea of multiculturalism, and that what defines your identity is where you were born, rather than what defines your identity is who your ancestors were. I mean, everybody knows that instinctually. Blood is thicker than water. Your identity is taken from who your ancestors were, not from where you're born. That's the false idea that we're being told. I think everybody would benefit from identifying with their ancestors, because what we have is we have black people identifying with their ancestors and also being told that they need to identify with the country, which then causes problems, because they will say, well, this country wasn't built for me. It's been racist against me. It wasn't built for me. And that's because we've tried to give them two different identities. And I think as nationalists, we should always encourage people to take their identity from their ancestry and to be proud of that and to want to do their best for their ancestry. I mean, that's effectively what nationalism, what being a nationalist is, isn't it, Max?
Absolutely. Absolutely right. Well, but as I said earlier on, it looks as though the pendulum is starting to swing back the other way now. I wish Amy Gallagher Hall the best with her battle against the NHS trust that she's suing, and I hope there are many more people like her that have the courage to challenge what's been going on in recent times.
Yeah, and it needs to be taken before the courts, because it is discrimination, and the more cases there are, and the more attention there is drawn to this, the more people of European ethnicity are going to start identifying with their identity. That, you know, the more we see this identity politics being used by blacks and non-whites, the more people are going to realize that that's what we need to be doing as people of European extraction. We also need to be engaging in identity politics, and we need to be taking our identity from our ancestry and campaigning for people. Other people groups to be doing that as well. I mean, this isn't supremacism. We're not saying, well, we want to be doing things for our identity and we don't want anybody else to be doing that. We want everybody to be doing that, you know, and that's the only way that we can progress, I think, as a people, because we have these multicultural countries now. It's going to be very difficult to get rid of them. And if you're going to have multicultural countries, at least you could do is have a voice for your people group. And we don't even have that at the moment. Anybody that speaks up for white people is accused of being a racist. And that has to change. Anyway, shall we move into our greatest Britons for today then, Max?
Yes, that would be excellent.
Okay, we're going to be talking about Sir Oswald Mosley again, and this is part 5, and we're going to talk about what happened at Cable Street today. In October 1936, Mosley and the British Union of Fascists attempted to march through an area with a high proportion of Jewish residents. Violence, since called the Battle of Cable Street, resulted between counter-protesters trying to block the march and police trying to force the perfectly legal march through. At length, Sir Philip Game, the police commissioner, disallowed the march from going ahead due to the counter-protesters' violence, and the British Union of Fascists abandoned it. And, you know, this is portrayed today as a great victory. It was a victory of the sensible anti-fascists against these horrible fascists. But essentially what it was violence from counter-protesters against non-violent protesters. It was a completely legal march that was then attacked by, as it says here, Jewish residents and other pro-communist groups and anti-fascist groups, and they were the ones that started the violence. Essentially, to say that this was a great thing, that they fought back the fascists, they're essentially silencing free speech, and they're saying, if somebody has a different point of view to you, you know, you're justified in using violence against them. And, you know, violence is never a solution. And yet that's the way that this is portrayed. Cable Street was a great thing. It was the defeat of the fascists. It wasn't. It was acceptance of violence. What do you know about Cable Street, Max?
My understanding of what took place at Cable Street is very similar to your own. And it is a glaring example of the use of violence for political purposes. And a situation where, as you say, it was anti-fascists that caused the violence, and that it was violence between them and the police rather than violence between them and the British Union of Fascists. And so the British Union of Fascists were patiently waiting for the signal from the police that they could begin their march through the area that they'd selected, through Cable Street. But what had happened was that the violence that came from Antifa, the anti-fascists, was so ferocious that the police eventually succumbed to the violence and backed down and allowed the violent demonstrators to have their way, which is why they then sort of tried to portray what had taken place as being a great victory, when in reality, for the vast majority of the people of our country, it was a surrender by the police to the will of the mob. And it should have been seen as a disgraceful episode where the police didn't actually do what they should have done, i.e. uphold the rule of law and make it absolutely sort of plain to the Antifa demonstrators that there can be nowhere in Britain that is off limits as far as the police are concerned. And so the police should have asserted their authority in the same way that they should have asserted their authority in countless other instances since, where The extreme left, the Antifa, where they have learned from what happened at Cable Street and they're inspired by what happened at Cable Street, and they constantly refer back to Cable Street and let's do it again against the police and the fascists, and where at innumerable demonstrations or that had been peaceably arranged and were peaceably being conducted in the years since then, we've had violent Antifa mobs attacking with all sorts of weapons. And it happened in Liverpool only a few days back, where there was a peaceful demonstration against the housing of migrants in that area, and it was a peaceful demonstration until the Antifa turned up with their van full of weapons and started attacking the police.
Well, there needs to be tolerance for people having different points of view. I mean, that's the thing. You should, if you're British, you should be able to go anywhere in the country. There shouldn't be any no-go areas because you have a different opinion to the people that are in that area. That's why it was important that the police prevented this from happening and allowed people to walk through there with a different point of view. And the people there, I mean, it says it was a high proportion of Jewish residents. I guess that you can sort of, what's implied by that is that they were supportive of communism and left-wing views. And if you're supportive of communism and left-wing views, you should understand that some people may have right-wing views, they may have nationalist views, and they should be able to get along without resorting to violence. If you want to have a debate with somebody, have a debate. You know, there's no need to resort to fisticuffs. And I mean, what we're talking here is like baseball bats and razor blades and horrific violence. And I mean, this in itself, what happened here at Cable Street, this tells us the reason why the British Union of Fascists had the black shirts. They had to have the black shirts. They had to have a security detail because they were violently attacked for having a different point of view to the left-wing people in the country. It wasn't that the British Union of Fascists were going to attack the communist meetings, going in to attack the people on the left, going in to attack the representatives of the Jewish community. It was all the other way around. They were the ones that were attacking the British Union of Fascists, and they had to have this security detail, which were the black shirts, to ensure that they were actually able to meet and talk about having a different opinion to these other groups. Mosley continued to organise marches policed by the black shirts, and the government was sufficiently concerned by this to pass the Public Order Act 1936, which, amongst other things, banned political uniforms and quasi-military-style organisations, and came into effect on the 1st of January 1937. And I think what they were concerned about here is the things that were happening in Germany, where you had the Storm Battalion, you had the Brown Shirts in Germany, and I think Hitler had come to power at this point. And I think Britain was concerned about that and what might happen with these black shirts. So they banned the political uniforms, and that law was used again, I think, against Spearhead in the 60s, against Colin Jordan's organisation, because they started wearing uniforms. And then it was used again, I think, against even against Britain First. You know, it's quite a serious law that you can't actually all wear the same clothes if you're part of a political organisation. In the London County Council elections in 1937, the British Union of Fascists stood in three wards. In East London, which was some former New Party seats, its strongest areas polling up to a quarter of the vote. Mosley made most of the black shirt employees redundant, some of whom then defected from the party, along with William Joyce, who thought that Mosley was not radical enough to succeed with the British Union of Fascists. So they obviously had to change the way that they were doing things here, because they weren't allowed to have this separate security detail. And I guess we do have security firms now, don't we? We have a lot of security firms and bouncers that get hired out to work in clubs. But if you're a political organisation, you're not allowed to have that, I guess. I guess that's what this is saying. What are your thoughts on this, Max?
Well, that rule only ever seems to be enforced against nationalist organisations. And so you have a situation where, again, Antifa very often turn up in what they call black bloc, I believe, which is all dressed in black with face masks, etc., because they don't want to be recognised by the police, but they can very easily recognise other members of their own organization. I don't know of any extreme left-wing organization that's ever been prosecuted for adopting that policy, whereas right-wing organizations have been prosecuted. And it was actually, there was a period quite some time back now, I think right back in the 80s, where the Liberal Democrats started wearing what appeared to be a political uniform. They started to dress in a very similar way. I mean, it wasn't officially a uniform, but they adopted this sort of orange colour and the logo of the bird flying, and there was quite a lot of talk by people from the centre as well as people from the right, critical of what of the fact that it appeared that the Liberal Democrats were veering towards having a political uniform, and you know, what implications did this have for the Public Order Act? As far as I'm aware, there weren't any prosecutions of the Liberal Democrats for appearing to wear a political uniform.
Makes me think perhaps people felt intimidated if they saw that people were wearing a political uniform, and that was probably one of the reasons that were given when they brought this law in. But then it makes you think, well, what about Muslims wearing burqas? What about the women wearing burqas? What about Muslim men wearing the robes that they wear? Is that not similar to a political uniform? Because Islam does have its political branch, and that is a way of saying that I am a member of this group, and nothing seems to get done about that. Whereas it would seem to me, if it's against the law to all be wearing the same uniform as part of a political organisation, why is it different for wearing a uniform if you're all a part of a particular religion? I mean, you could say that with the Sikhs as well, with their turbans. They're all wearing the same thing. And it may be that people might feel intimidated by that, by seeing lots of people with turbans on or lots of people with a burqa on. I'm surprised that hasn't ever been brought up, is the similarity with this law that banned political uniforms. I guess it's because they say it's a quasi-military style organisation. So maybe the two have to be put together, all wearing a uniform and also being part of a security detail. And I guess they could say that obviously Muslim women are not part of a military style security detail, although it could be argued that they are wearing political uniforms. Well, in October 1937 in Liverpool, Mosley himself was knocked unconscious by two stones thrown by crowd members after he delivered a fascist salute to 8,000 people from the top of a van in Waltham. And it doesn't tell us whether these were 8,000 supporters, just 8,000 members of the public, but this just shows you the sort of disgusting behaviour that there is by our opponents, throwing stones at somebody. And they hit him as well, knocked unconscious by somebody throwing stones at them in the 20th century in Britain. And instead of the person that was attacked and had the stones thrown at him being raised up, and this poor victim, you know, it's lionized. This sort of behavior is lionized. The people that attacked the British Union of Fascists are made out to be these great heroes and saviors of democracy today. And yet they were just violent thugs.
Attacking democracy. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I can remember years ago in my youth attending a National Front demonstration in Bradford, where a group of about 2,000 left-wing students and demonstrators turned up when at a point where the nationalist organisers were only just starting to arrive at this green in the middle of Bradford in order to begin their what was going to be a march through the centre of Bradford. And this left-wing mob just went completely crazy, and I actually witnessed them pulling down the walls in the front of people's terrace houses and taking the bricks that they'd obtained from that, and then just showering both the police and the National Front demonstrators with bricks and bottles and all sorts of missiles that they could lay their hands on. I saw a police horse pulled over and injured as a result of, you know, the policeman becoming surrounded, and it was a full scale riot. And but again, the police acted with, in my view, an unreasonable amount of leniency towards the left-wing demonstrators, because, you know, it was just a violent mob, and they should have got more police there, and they should have dealt with them far more severely, in my view.
Well, that's an example of real hatred in action, isn't it? I mean, if people are throwing stones at somebody, they must really, really hate them. They hate them that much that, you know, they would like to kill them. That's why they're throwing stones at them. That's why they're throwing rocks at them. And yet we're told, oh, we are inciting hate if we use an old-fashioned term for somebody who is non-white, or we are inciting hate if we point out the crime statistics. I mean, the people that are really carrying out hate are our opponents. I mean, what they're doing here, throwing stones, attacking people, it's effectively terrorism, because what they're trying to do is achieve a political aim. The political aim is to shut down the speech of their opponents, and they use violence to do so. And it's never the other way around. You'll never hear of a communist talk or a left-wing talk in a building, the right-wing turns up, a violent right-wing mob turns up throwing stones and throwing bricks at them. You never hear of it. And yet we're the ones that are accused of being against democracy. As you pointed out there, Max, they're the ones that are the threat to democracy, because democracy can only function when you have a free exchange of ideas, when you have a free debate about things. And, you know, that's what used to be so great about Britain, is you could debate these ideas. We did live in a fairly free society, but over the last 60 or 70 years, we've had all these different laws brought in to try to restrict our speech. And if that wasn't good enough for the left, you know, they want to carry out violence against us as well, to try and shut down our speech. It really makes you think, you know, what is it they're so worried about? You know, why is it that they can't stand to actually have a debate with us and you know, just calmly discuss these ideas? Why do they have to resort to violence? And I think a lot of people on the left, people that aren't really that political, they don't know that that goes on, because they just read the mainstream media. They don't realise that there is so much violence and hatred that comes from our opponents. You know, that they think, well, you know, we would debate these things, and our ideas have been shown to be false, and you know, that's why we're deplatformed or whatever. But it's not. It's they completely refuse to actually debate these ideas, because you'll see people on the left and they'll say, well, you know, it's a good debate that gets rid of bad ideas, bad ideology. You know, these people need to be debated. And you see, like, old left-wing people writing that in comment sections. And they think that, you know, that's what happens. That isn't what happens. It's violence gets used against us to prevent us from being able to talk about the subjects that we want to talk about. Now, as the European situation moved towards war, the British Union of Fascists began to nominate parliamentary by-election candidates and launched campaigns on the theme of Mind Britain's Business. Mosley remained popular as late as summer 1939, and his Britain First rally at the Earl's Court Exhibition Hall on 16th of July 1939 was the biggest indoor political rally in all of Britain's history, with a reported 30,000 attendees. So Mosley really didn't want war, and he wasn't alone in not wanting war. Everybody that took part in the First World War that was still alive didn't want war either. You had a lot of generals that were saying, you know, what is this? Why are we heading towards another war? And he was extremely popular. But after the outbreak of war, Mosley led the campaign for a negotiated peace. But after the fall of France and the commencement of aerial bombardment during the Battle of Britain, overall public opinion of him became hostile. And in May 1940, he was nearly wounded by an assault. And when I talk to people that aren't nationalists, and you bring up Mosley, sort of older people in their 70s, you know, they don't have a very high opinion of him, and their impression of him is that he was a traitor. He had to be locked up during the war because, you know, he would have allowed the Germans to come into the country, and that wasn't the case. And that's the general opinion of him, is that he was a traitor, and this is because all of them got locked up, which we'll get to in a minute. But he was campaigning on peace, and he did have a lot of support for peace. But I guess that once war broke out, you have to support your country, don't you? And as far as I know, Mosley did support his country, and he did tell the people in the BUF, now we're at war, you have to, you know, fight for your country, and that's it. But it seems that the authorities didn't believe him on that, because they ended up locking them up. Any thoughts on this, Max, and the campaign of peace and not war?
Yes, I think that once war was declared, anybody campaigning against a war was seen as being a traitor. You know, which is the wrong position to take, because even at time of war, if you're a democracy and you're fighting for democracy, then by that principle, you should allow everybody to have their say, even the people that disagree with you. But democracy during the Second World War didn't mean that everybody should have their voice. It meant that only people who wanted to pursue war were allowed to speak out in public. And Mosley was locked up together with the vast majority of the supporters of the British Union of Fascists. But many of the British Union of Fascists did actually join the armed forces and did go and fight against Italy and against Germany during the Second World War. And, you know, lots of them were injured, and lots of them were commended for their bravery in the field of battle. So they did take part. And so really there wasn't sufficient reason for Mosley and all of his supporters, or most of his supporters, to be locked up in the way that they were. That was just a waste of resources and a waste of manpower.
And we do have some interviews with an eyewitness that was actually talking about this time and what went on when they were locked up. And you can find them at radioalbion.com. I think it's under the British history section. The chap that we were interviewing is called Mr. I. But we'll move into a summary of what happened here. And I'm getting this from a pro-Mosley website rather than from Wikipedia. Unbeknown to Mosley, MI5 and the Special Branch had deeply penetrated the British Union of Fascists and were also monitoring him through listening devices. Beginning in 1934, they were increasingly worried that Mosley's noted oratory skills would convince the public to provide financial support to the BUF, enabling it to challenge the political establishment. His agitation was officially tolerated until the events of the Battle of France in May 1940 made the government consider him too dangerous. Mosley, who at that time was focused on pleading for the British to accept Hitler's peace offer of March, was detained on the 23rd of May 1940, less than a fortnight after Winston Churchill became Prime Minister. And I think that probably had a lot to do with it, that Winston Churchill was Prime Minister. Winston Churchill had been wanting war with Germany for quite some years. And a lot of the public are still unaware to this day that Hitler actually made so many peace offers. And if you consider it at this point, after the Battle of France, they had just occupied France. They had just swept through Europe right the way up to the English Channel. And instead of making threats, Hitler straight away said, I want peace. We will withdraw from France. All we have to do is accept the peace offer. We will withdraw from France. We will withdraw from all of these countries that we've occupied. We only had to occupy them to prevent them from becoming a gateway for the Allies to come through to attack Germany. So he had literally conquered France, and he's making a peace offer and saying that he will withdraw from France. And instead of that, we made Winston Churchill Prime Minister. And Churchill locked up Mosley. Any thoughts on this, Max? The invasion of France, Dunkirk?
Yeah, I think, there was the use of the Blitzkrieg technique in order to break through the Allied defences, which enabled the German army to swoop round and then push the British Expeditionary Force into the coastal areas around Dunkirk and Calais. There was a great danger at that particular time, because there were some panzer regiments or whatever available that Hitler could have used to have then driven down to the coast, could have taken the coastal towns, and they could have then either captured or slaughtered the British expeditionary force that was stranded on the beach there. It is noted by a number of British historians of the time, and I believe A.J.P. Taylor, who was a very left-wing a historian at the time, even acknowledged that Hitler had given the order for the panzers to hold back for 48 hours to give the British forces time to leave and to be evacuated from Dunkirk. Not that it wasn't a great achievement evacuating from Dunkirk, but just that it could have been a far more bloody episode, and there could have been a far more loss of life from the British Expeditionary Force. And the justification given for it I can't remember where I've read it, but in various speeches and writings made by Hitler at the time, was that he didn't want Britain to feel humiliated by having their army destroyed on the coast of France, and that's why he felt that if he allowed them sufficient time to get sufficient troops away such that they could withdraw without having a total loss of face, that it was more likely that the British government would agree to a ceasefire and to peace.
I think he was,
but obviously that didn't happen.
Yeah, I think he was expecting Britain to act honourably. If you think Hitler had his enemy where he wanted them, you know, he could have either taken all the Britons prisoner, could have attacked them, could have killed them all, literally had defeated Britain, had the whole army there. And instead of taking them prisoner, instead of shooting them all or whatever, he allowed them to go back to Britain and then made this peace offer. And I think he was expecting Britain to act honourably and say, yes, you could have won the war, but instead of that huge loss of life, you've allowed us to escape all alive. So we will go for the negotiated peace. And I think that's what Hitler was expecting. He was expecting Britain to act honourably. I mean, it's rather like it's a biblical story of King David, and he's not king yet, and he's in a cave, and King Saul comes into a cave and he relieves himself, I think, and David cuts off a bit of his cape. Instead of killing him, he cuts off a bit of his cape, and then he shows him, or it gets shown to him, that he could have killed him, but he didn't. And then peace is made, because he could have killed him and he didn't. And that would have been the honourable thing to occur at this point, because Hitler could have just completely wiped out the British forces. I mean, he would have won the war, wouldn't he? So he could have won the war, but he didn't. He did the honourable thing and said, we'll let you leave with all your lives intact. This is ridiculous. Why are brothers fighting? And Churchill's response to that was to stick Moseley in prison and continue fighting the war. It's, awful. Well, Moseley was interrogated for 16 hours by Lord Birkett, but was never formally charged with a crime and was instead interned under Defence Regulation 18B. So he had no habeas corpus, hadn't been found guilty of anything, hadn't been charged with a crime. They broke the Magna Carta, where you have to actually be charged with something to be kept in prison, and they just kept him in prison under this Defence Regulation 18B that they created. The other most active fascists in Britain met the same fate, resulting in the British Union of Fascists' practical removal at an organised level from the United Kingdom's political stage. Moseley's wife, Diana, was also interned in June, shortly after the birth of their son, Max Moseley. And the Moseleys lived together for most of the war in a house in the grounds of Holloway Prison. And the BUF was prescribed by the British government later that year. And it was a huge number of them that were locked up, and there was no provisions put in place for their wives or their families. So they lost all of their income. It was an absolutely awful thing to happen. It went against all our traditions, all our hard fought for rights to be putting people in prison without them having done anything wrong. And that was Churchill's act, basically. Moseley used the time in confinement to read extensively in classics, particularly regarding politics and war, with a focus upon key historical figures. He refused visits from most BUF members, but on 18th of March 1943, Dudley and Nora Elam, who had been released by then, that's near the end of the war, accompanied Unity Mitford to see her sister. Diana. You remember Unity. Mitford was the one that wanted peace. So we talked a little bit about her last time, didn't we? Unity, Valkyrie.
Yes, that's right.
Mitford, and she shot herself in the head. Do you want to just run through that, Max? Because we talk about that afterwards, and I didn't remember the details last time. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yes, Unity Valkyrie Mitford, I think was her full name, was a sister of Diana Moseley, and she was from an early age besotted with Hitler, and she went over to Germany and met with him on a number of occasions. But it became obvious that there wasn't going to be any kind of a relationship developing between them. And in her sort of adolescent passion, Unity Mitford decided to shoot herself in the head, but wasn't particularly accurate in terms of angling the gun so that instead of the bullet going through her head and killing her, it just was delivered a glancing blow to her skull, which I imagine probably caused a certain amount of damage to the skull and the brain beneath it, and she was then disabled thereafter.
Yeah, I think it was on the outbreak of war as well. The fact that England and Germany were at war,
I think so.
And she shot herself. So Nora Elam, accompanied by Unity Mitford, went to see Diana. Moseley agreed to be present because he mistakenly believed that it was Lady Reedsdale, who was Diana and Unity's mother, who was accompanying Unity. The internment, particularly that of Lady Moseley, resulted in significant public debate in the press, although most of the public supported the government's actions. Others demanded a trial, either in the hope that it would end the detention or in the hope of a conviction. During his internment, he developed what would become a lifelong friendship with fellow prisoner Cathair Healy, a Catholic Irish nationalist MP for the Northern Irish Parliament. And again, this here, it says that others were demanding a trial. They didn't want this internment. I mean, the public really did turn against him. As I say, the elderly people that I've spoken to about Moseley, they all understood it, that he was a traitor, that he was guilty of supporting Germany once war had started. But that wasn't what happened. They could find no evidence of that at all, and they refused to have a trial because he would have been asking for a trial. He would have been demanding his habeas corpus. And he wasn't given that. That's why he was hoping that it was Lady Reedsdale that was going to be coming to speak to them. In November 1943, the Home Secretary, Herbert Morrison, ordered the release of the Moseleys. After a fierce debate in the House of Commons, Morrison's action was upheld by a vote of 327 to 26. Moseley, who was suffering with phlebitis, spent the rest of the war confined under house arrest and police supervision. On his release from prison, he first stayed with his sister-in-law, Pamela Mitford, followed shortly by a stay at the Shaven Crown Hotel in Shipton under Wychwood, and he then purchased Crux Eastern House near Newbury with Diana, and he and his wife remained the subject of much press attention. And I may have been wrong there. I may have actually got that from Wikipedia, because we've got some more on Regulation 18B here, which is quite detailed. So I made a mistake there saying that it was from the site that was sympathetic to Moseley. We'll get into that next week. We'll get into more details of Regulation 18B there. So he was finally released, but you imagine the damage that did to him. Phlebitis,
yes.
You know, being in prison. The prison food and the rest of it.
Yeah, it's likely that the incarceration in prison was instrumental in affecting his health.
Yeah, I mean, at least it says there he spent his time reading, I guess, but there were lots of them. I can recall some quote that was saying that when they were all interned, you never saw so many generals and high up members of the army ever in one place before, effectively saying that all the people that were put in prison alongside him had all fought with distinction in the First World War. They're all the people that didn't want to go to war, and you know they were good people that had served their country, and that's why they didn't want to go to war again. I forget what the exact quote is. It may have been something about all the medals that they had in the prison ground there. But yeah, he's treated abominably, really, to think that there was no evidence against him. he should have been free to go. He should have been free to fight in the war against the Germans. But I guess they had this doubt that because of that, that because of the he had wanted to stop the war, because he was a fascist and the fascists were allied with the National Socialists. You know, I guess there is this argument to be made that you know, perhaps there could have been issues there. But if that was the case, then they should have made certain that they really looked after them well, rather than putting them in prison. Surely, you know, house arrest would have been a better thing to do rather than putting them in prison when they actually hadn't actually done anything wrong. And it really did smear his reputation, as I say, because if you talk to elderly people that aren't nationalists, do you remember Oswald Mosley? Oh, yes, he was the traitor that would have allowed the Germans to get into Britain if he could. So he was put in prison. And I guess once he was in prison, there was no chance of him getting the truth out of what had happened either. The newspapers would have all been very, very, very negative about him. Unfortunately, he never rose back up to the political heights that he had after the war. But we'll get into more details on this Regulation 18B next week, I think, Max. We'll leave that here for today.
Okay.
So thank you very much for coming on today.
That's my pleasure as always.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.